and another indication of how much he valued education. As to his difficulties with the code of conduct of an officer, Lewis took them in his stride. "The general idea is that the army is the school of debauchery," he wrote, "but believe me, it has ever proven the school of experience and prudence to your affectionate son." He was apparently learning to be less provocative in his politics, however. He addressed the letter to Mrs. Lucy Marks, M-A-R-K-S, not Citizen Lucy Marks, M-A-R-K-E-S. He never could decide how to spell Marks. His army life over the next 4 years gave him enough travel to satisfy even his rambling nature. He covered vast chunks of the West, north and south of the Ohio River, beginning with a reconnaissance through Ohio in the spring of 1796. In October, he marched from Detroit to Pittsburgh with a small escort, delivering dispatches. He got lost twice and ran out of rations. He found some abandoned and rotting bear meat in an old Indian camp and pronounced it very acceptable. In November 1796, he transferred to the 1st U.S. Infantry Regiment. That month, he made another march from Detroit to Pittsburgh, again carrying dispatches for General Wayne. This time, he did not get lost, perhaps because he was accompanied by a Wyandot Indian who probably served as a guide. The Indian's name was Enos Coon, and Lewis paid his bill at a Pittsburgh inn. Following that journey, he took a furlough and rode home to Locust Hill, his first time there since he left in August 1794, promising his mother to return in 6 months. No anecdotes survive from the visit, but apparently he made the rounds of his old friends after satisfying his mother's desire to know about his adventures and arranging his business affairs at the plantation. Invited to join the Virtue Lodge No. 44 of the Masonic Order in Albemarle, he did so on January 28, 1797. He advanced through Masonic degrees with dizzying speed. By April 3rd, he was the recipient of the degree of Past Master Mason. Because his military duties kept him out of Albemarle most of the time over the following years, he attended few lodge meetings, although he was present in June and July 1798 while on furlough. He was an officer in the lodge and that summer made a motion to earmark a portion of lodge funds for charity. By October 1799, he was a Royal Arch Mason. He apparently took the ritual and idealism of the Masons quite seriously. He later gave names taken from Masonic ritual to Western rivers: philosophy, wisdom, and philanthropy. William Clark joined the Masons in St. Louis in 1809. Lewis's furlough extended through the summer of 1797, during which time he settled my domestic concerns. He made arrangements to bring some of his mother's slaves, still in Georgia, back to Virginia, made a trip to Kentucky to do some additional speculating in land. He bought 2,600 acres for himself at 20 cents per acre, telling his mother, "I am much more pleased with this country than I supposed I should." Sold some of his Virginia land to his brother Reuben, bought some of Captain Marks's land from his mother, and generally acted as Virginia planters did in those years, making himself land rich and cash poor. In an age of powdered wigs, lace, and ruffles, he was something of a fop. In a January 15, 1798 letter to a friend, Lieutenant Ferdinand Claiborne, he complained about his tailor. "Of all the damned pieces of work," he wrote, "my coat exceeds. It would take up 3 sheets of paper written in shorthand to point out its deficiencies, or I may even say deformities. The lace is deficient. Could I have done without it, I should have returned it." In a postscript, he made a complaint about a military matter, a complaint that virtually every officer in every army in every age has made. "No doubt you have had forwarded to you the late regulation of our generous Congress relative to the delivery and distribution of fuel and straw to the garrisons. The allowance falling so far short of what is really necessary, I am at a loss to determine what steps to pursue. Do let me know what plan you adapt, as I am confident the proportion of fuel is so small that the soldiers cannot subsist on it." In 1798, John Adams was president. Thanks to Jay's treaty, relations with England were good, which meant that relations with France were bad. There was an undeclared war on the high seas. French Foreign Minister Talleyrand demanded a bribe from an American mission. Public opinion was outraged. Political parties were formed around these events, which ushered in one of the most bitterly partisan periods in American history. At the center of the disputes was the size of the army. The High Federalists, led by Alexander Hamilton, hoped to use the crisis of a threatened war with France to build a classic European-style standing army, meaning one designed more to suppress internal dissent than to repel foreign invasion. Hamilton, and to a lesser extent Washington and Adams, who were not High Federalists, regarded the Republican opposition to government policy, led by Jefferson, as illegitimate, even treasonous, an attitude that led to the Alien and Sedition Acts. In July 1798, the Federalist-controlled Congress voted for a huge increase in the army, authorizing as many as 10,000 regulars and 30,000 militia. To President Adams and other Federalist leaders, the appointment of men of sound politics to the officer corps of the new army was crucial if that army was to provide a reliable check on internal disorder. As active politicians, Adams and his friends were also aware of the vast patronage possibilities in the expansion of the army. But the Federalist Party was divided internally between Hamilton's High Federalist faction and Adams's supporters, so a struggle for power lay ahead. Adams appointed Washington to command the new army, with the rank of lieutenant general. Washington, reluctant to end his retirement, did so only partially, for he insisted on remaining at Mount Vernon until war actually began. That decision meant that the second in command would have effective control of the new army. A series of cabinet intrigues followed that soon embroiled Adams and Washington in a controversy over Hamilton. Eventually, Washington forced Adams to make a humiliating concession, threatening to resign unless Adams agreed to make Hamilton the second in command. The humiliation caused Adams to have second thoughts about the expansion of the army. As a consequence, it did not grow to anything remotely approaching the authorized strength. In practice, there was a rapid increase in the officer corps, but almost none in the enlisted ranks. That meant that Adams still had many commissions to hand out, and they were eagerly sought. Federalists naturally got the lion's share. Washington established the criteria. He proposed giving first priority to active revolutionary veterans, and the second to young gentlemen of good families, liberal education, and high sense of honor. In no case, Washington told Adams, should he appoint any who are known enemies to their own government, for they will certainly attempt to create disturbances in the military. Adams went so far in excluding applicants suspected of republicanism that even Hamilton thought he had gone too far. Hamilton said that some at least of the junior officers should come from the opposition ranks. It does not seem advisable to exclude all hope and give to appointments too absolute a party feature. Military situations, on young minds particularly, are of all others best calculated to inspire a zeal for the service and the cause in which the incumbents are employed. In other words, young Republicans of promise and talent could be won over if given a commission. Adams tended to ignore Hamilton. The vast majority of appointments went to Federalists. Even though they were officers without an army, their political orientation struck fear in the hearts of the Republicans, who talked, somewhat wildly, about the coming Federalist terror. The involvement of the army in politics and the use of the officer corps as a major patronage source was destined to have a decisive impact on Meriwether Lewis. It began with a promotion. On March 3, 1799, he became a lieutenant and was posted to recruiting duty in Charlottesville, which must have pleased his mother. After Adams made his decision to ignore the authorization to increase the enlisted ranks of the army by several thousand, Lewis's recruiting duties ran out. In 1800, he was posted to Detroit, where he joined a company commanded by his friend Captain Claiborne. It was a presidential election year, with Jefferson challenging Adams. Lewis indulged in vigorous political argument, on at least one occasion exchanging hot words with the Federalist officer and overwhelming, at least to his own satisfaction, the Fed with his own Jeffersonian Republican arguments. He shortly became regimental paymaster. This was a new post provided for by Congress in March 1799 as part of the expansion. He got the appointment, Jefferson later wrote, because he always attracted the first attention where punctuality and fidelity were requisite. It was an ideal posting for Lewis for two reasons. The first was personal. His duties gave him a veritable carte blanche for rambling. The second was political. The rambling gave him an opportunity to get to know the officers scattered throughout the West and to assess their political views, thereby acquiring knowledge that soon became a great asset. He roamed the West, up and down the Ohio River, Cincinnati, Fort Wayne, Limestone, Maysville, Chillicothe, Wheeling, on a 21-foot bateau or keelboat and a pirogue. He learned the craft of a waterman on Western rivers. He traveled by horseback to forts south of the Ohio, riding through the wilderness carrying large sums in banknotes, not hard currency, which was too bulky. He kept extensive records, transfers, AWOLs, deserters, recruits. He established a reputation for thoroughness, accuracy, and honesty. On December 5, 1800, Lewis was promoted to captain. That month, the state selected their delegates to the Electoral College. In February 1801, those delegates created a political crisis when the count came out 73 votes each for Jefferson and his running mate, Aaron Burr of New York, with 65 votes for Adams. The tie threw the election into the House of Representatives, where another deadlock followed, as the Federalist Caucus decided to back Burr. In other words, the Federalists would not accept the outcome of the election, in which the people's choice of Jefferson was clear. So intense was the partisanship of the day, so much did the Federalists hate and fear Jefferson, that they were ready to turn the country over to Aaron Burr. Had they succeeded and made Burr the president, there would almost certainly be no republic today. Fortunately for all, Hamilton was smart enough and honest enough to realize that Jefferson was the lesser evil. He used his influence to break the deadlock. On the 36th ballot, February 17, 1801, Jefferson was chosen president and Burr was elected vice president. It was an age marked by a certain extravagance of language. What the alarmists among the Federalists feared, they said, was the general ascendancy of the worthless, the dishonest, the rapacious, the vile, the merciless, and the ungodly. Such sentiments emboldened Adams to radical measures. On March 3rd, hours before Jefferson's inaugural, Adams made his famous midnight appointments, stuffing the federal courts with Federalist judges. Not so well known, but equally outrageous, at least to the Republicans, was his commissioning of 87 men to fill vacancies in the 6 regiments of the permanent military establishment. Virtually all were Federalists, thus guaranteeing that the Army, like the courts, would remain predominantly Federalist for years to come. Or so, at least, Adams hoped. President Jefferson had other ideas. To implement them, he turned to his neighbor, Captain Meriwether Lewis of the 1st Infantry. Chapter 4. Thomas Jefferson's America, 1801. When Thomas Jefferson took the oath of office as the 3rd President of the United States on March 4, 1801, the nation contained 5,308,483 persons. Nearly 1 out of 5 was a Negro slave. Although the boundaries stretched from the Atlantic to the Mississippi River, from the Great Lakes nearly to the Gulf of Mexico, roughly 1,000 miles by 1,000 miles, only a relatively small area was occupied. 2/3 of the people lived within 50 miles of tidewater. Only 4 roads crossed the Appalachian Mountains, one from Philadelphia to Pittsburgh, another from the Potomac to the Monongahela River, a third through Virginia southwestward to Knoxville, Tennessee, and the fourth through the Cumberland Gap into Kentucky. The potential of the United States was, if not limitless, certainly vast, and vastly greater if the nation could add the trans-Mississippi portion of the continent to its territory. In 1801, however, it was not clear the country could hold on to its existing territory between the Appalachians and the Mississippi, much less add more western land. Fewer than 1 out of 10 Americans, about 500,000 people, lived west of the Appalachian Mountains, but as the Whiskey Rebellion had shown, they were already disposed to think of themselves as the germ of an independent nation that would find its outlet to the world marketplace not across the mountains to the Atlantic seaboard, but by the Ohio and Mississippi River system to the Gulf of Mexico. This threat of secession was quite real. The United States was only 18 years old, had itself come into existence by an act of rebellion and secession, had changed its form of government just 12 years earlier, and thus was in a fluid political situation. In addition, it seemed unlikely that one nation could govern an entire continent. the distances were just too great. A critical fact in the world of 1801 was that nothing moved faster than the speed of a horse. No human being, no manufactured item, no bushel of wheat, no side of beef, or any beef on the hoof for that matter, no letter, no information, no idea, order, or instruction of any kind moved faster. Nothing ever had moved any faster, and as far as Jefferson's contemporaries were able to tell, nothing ever would. And except on a racetrack, no horse moved very fast. Road conditions in the United States ranged from bad to abominable, and there weren't very many of them. The best highway in the country ran from Boston to New York. It took a light stagecoach, carrying only passengers, their baggage, and the mail, changing horses at every way station, 3 full days to make the 175-mile journey. The 100 miles from New York to Philadelphia took 2 days. South of the new capital city of Washington, D.C., there were no roads suitable for a stagecoach. Everything moved on horseback. Of 8 rivers between here, Monticello, and Washington, Jefferson wrote in 1801, 5 have neither bridges nor boats. It took Jefferson 10 days to go the 225 miles from Monticello to Philadelphia. To the west, beyond the mountains, there were no roads at all, only trails. To move men or mail from the Mississippi River to the Atlantic seaboard took 6 weeks or more. Anything heavier than a letter took 2 months at least. Bulky items, such as bushels of grain, bales of fur, barrels of whiskey, or kegs of gunpowder, could be moved only by horse, ox, or mule-drawn wagons, whose carrying capacity was severely limited, even where roads existed. People took it for granted that things would always be this way. The idea of progress based on technological improvements or mechanics, the notion of a power source other than muscle, falling water, or wind, was utterly alien to virtually every American. Writing in the last decade of the 19th century about conditions in the year of Jefferson's inaugural, Henry Adams observed that, "Great as were the material obstacles in the path of the United States, the greatest obstacle of all was in the human mind." Down to the close of the 18th century, no change had occurred in the world which warranted practical men in assuming that great changes were to come. Jefferson was an exception. He had a marvelous imagination. Monticello was stuffed with gadgets he had invented. He also had developed practical devices for the general good of mankind. Farmers in Europe and America up to the end of the 18th century had used wooden plows with straight mold boards that showed no improvement over those of the ancient Romans. It was Jefferson who developed the curved mold board plow. In 1793, he saw a hot air balloon ascent. Though it was presented as an entertainment, he at once saw a potential practical application. "The security of the thing appeared so great," he wrote to his daughter Martha, "that I wish for one sincerely to travel in, as instead of 10 days, I should be within 5 hours of home." With regard to travel by air, Jefferson was a full century ahead of the curve. With regard to travel by land, he imagined the possibility of locomotion by something other than horsepower. He was attracted by the idea of using steam power to move carriages. In 1802, he predicted, "The introduction of so powerful an agent as steam to a carriage on wheels will make a great change in the situation of man." Jefferson was 100 years ahead of the automobile, however powered. He never saw a train. With regard to travel by water, Jefferson in 1801 could not imagine any way to overcome the difficulties or to improve the advantages of this most essential means of transportation for commerce. At the beginning of the 19th century, all heavy items or items in any quantity moved over water, either in canoes powered by human muscle, or on rafts floating down rivers, or on barges on canals drawn by mules, or on sailing ships propelled by the wind. Because the movement of commerce was by water, Americans of 1801 were constantly thinking about water. Their heads were full of schemes to build canals, using locks to advance upriver or to go around rapids. Jefferson wrote of a people occupied as we are in opening rivers, digging navigable canals, making roads. Since the birth of civilization, there had been almost no changes in commerce or transportation. Americans lived in a free and democratic society, the first in the world since ancient Greece, a society that read Shakespeare and had produced George Washington and Thomas Jefferson, but a society whose technology was barely advanced over that of the Greeks. The Americans of 1801 had more gadgets, better weapons, a superior knowledge of geography, and other advantages over the ancients, but they could not move goods or themselves or information by land or water any faster than had the Greeks and Romans. In Henry Adams's words, "Rip Van Winkle, who woke from his long slumber about the year 1800, saw little that was new to him except the head of President Washington where that of King George had once hung." Describing the mindset of the time, Adams wrote, "Experience forced on men's minds the conviction that what had ever been must ever be." But only 60 years later, when Abraham Lincoln took the oath of office as the 16th President of the United States, Americans could move bulky items in great quantity farther in an hour than Americans of 1801 could do in a day, whether by land, 25 miles per hour on railroads, or water, 10 miles an hour upstream on a steamboat. This great leap forward in transportation, a factor of 20 or more, in so short a space of time must be reckoned as the greatest and most unexpected revolution of all, except for another technological revolution, the transmitting of information. In Jefferson's day, it took 6 weeks to move information from the Mississippi River to Washington, D.C. In Lincoln's, information moved over the same route by telegraph, all but instantaneously. Time and distance, mountains and rivers, meant something entirely different to Thomas Jefferson from what they meant to Abraham Lincoln. Rivers dominated.